Welcome to Newsworthy with Norrisworthy. Get ready for some awesome.
Welcome back to the show, friends. Today we're doing our October wrap-up show with my good friend from Dallas, Texas, the Senator Wade Hodges.
How's it going, my friend?
Good. How are you?
Pretty good. I love the idea that you think your podcast needs a wrap-up. Tell me about that. What is a wrap-up?
Well, I think we've got to give the people what they want. And this is a chance for us to kind of go back through, talk about some stuff that we brought up earlier in the month. And there's always some scraps left on the table, and we don't want to just throw them away. We want to eat them. We want to consume them. We want to have a good conversation over some items that should have been addressed that didn't get addressed during the shows.
There are times when I'm listening, and I think I really wish Luke had asked this question or at least disagreed with this point that a guest made. And so you're saying this is a chance maybe to give you a chance to do a do-over on some of the opportunities you missed? Is that what we're doing here?
Exactly.
Awesome.
Exactly. Yeah,
awesome.
There's always stuff to talk about.
Yeah, well, you threw me for a loop last week.
What? Oh, my goodness. What happened, Wade?
Well, you are known throughout the interwebs as a famous podcaster.
Well, I don't know about famous, but yes.
You are casting the pod all over the world, and yet here you are showing up on our good friend Scott McKnight's Jesus Creed blog as a blogger.
Ooh, yeah.
You wrote a blog post, and Scott put it on his blog, probably one of the most widely read Christian blogs that I know of.
You think so? Most widely read?
I would think so.
Oh, wow.
And so you probably had a lot of eyeballs on that blog post. And I noticed that some of the comments that came in, I'm not going to say they were negative, but they didn't necessarily agree with the basic premise of the blog post. Would you say that's fair?
Well, first of all, I think all those people were clearly wrong themselves.
There was pushback.
There was a few people. Now, the weirdest thing to me, well, and you've done more blogging than I ever done. You used to have a very popular blog. You used to have a blog that was updated regularly. You had online conversations going on all the time. So you know more about this than me. But after writing one blog post, my initial thought was, why in the world do people do this?
Yeah.
Like, I saw there was a little bit of conversation there. And the blog post was, I don't even know what it was titled. It was something about, I've got this hang up where I can't stand where people who are paid pastors in churches, they say that we don't have religion, we have a relationship. I just think that's so self-contradictory. Like, you reap all the benefits of a religion. You get a tax deduction, you have, you know, all these benefits from being a religious person, but you pretend like you're not really one. And so I just think that's kind of self-contradictory. Let's just say it is what it is. It's self-contradiction.
Right.
Well, I read 1,100 words, which I'm not great with math, but that's like six tweets strapped together.
I thought you were going to say you're not great with words, but not great with math. I got it.
I'm not going to debate the second one. I mean, I might not be great with either one, but that's okay. We're all friends here. And they're comments that are just as long as the entire blog that I wrote. I mean, this is 1,100 words. I can't speak to the full experience of everyone who's ever been involved with religion or who's ever said that very trite platitude.
Right. Not a research paper.
No, it's not.
Not a carefully constructed argument that's going to be published in a book and is going to exist 100 years down the road for people to look at.
No, there's no editor.
You took a position. You made a point. You tried to say it as well as you can. But you also, because of constraints of the blog, you had to say it within a certain amount of...
Uncle Scott only gave me 1,100 words. That's all I had.
Yeah. And one of the things I learned when I was blogging, and I don't blog much anymore, almost not at all anymore, but one of the things I realized was that there are some people who love to read blogs and actually have more time to comment on your blog than you actually have time to write blogs.
Mm.
And I think that's a problem. When somebody can read a blog that maybe you whipped out in an hour because you had time and you couldn't cover all your bases, and then they can sit there for the next hour, hour and a half, picking it apart and writing, like you say, a comment that's four times as long as your blog post.
Yeah. Did you usually respond to people who were critiquing your blogs?
Not usually. Maybe one line as thanks for commenting. I can certainly understand why you'd see it differently. But most of the time, I didn't have time to get engaged in a deep online conversation with a commenter, especially somebody who disagrees and you want to work through all the nuances of the argument. I didn't have time with that. I had a job. I had other things. I had sermons to write. I had other things to do working with my church. And so I don't have time to invest a bunch of energy into responding to blog comments.
I felt like I needed to respond to the people who are critiquing me, because a few comments up front were nice. Hey, thanks for this. This is a good idea. Blah, blah, blah. I like your podcast. And so I responded to them. And then as the deluge of criticism came in, I'm like, oh, I got to be consistent and at least respond to all of these. And after a while, I just stopped even looking. But I see Beck. He does a lot of response on his blog, which is impressive. I don't know how people do that. I mean, whatever.
Well, and more blogs that I have seen are actually going away from comments because they're becoming more negative, more critical, and maybe less helpful. Yeah. So I think you definitely make – I think I could see if I were blogging regularly again, if I don't have time to monitor the comments, don't have time to actually interact with commenters, it might be better to do away with them altogether and just put the material out there and let people respond to it on Facebook or something like that.
Yeah, that makes sense. And if it's on Facebook, there's a little bit more accountability that you're a real person and we see who you are, and then therefore your comments come out. But again, it's not like there every comment was bad, and not that every commenter had terrible things to say. Some of them probably had more accuracy in their statement than I had in my entire blog. So,
Favorite comment, though, was essentially one guy said, "I appreciate the blog post, although I found nothing relevant in it whatsoever."
That's pretty funny.
How do you appreciate a blog post that you think is totally irrelevant?
I really appreciate what you said. It was all complete crap, but I really appreciate you. That was a really thoughtful thing. I think he actually threw a love you in there as well.
Yeah. If that was a feedback sandwich, I'm not going to eat at that guy's diner.
No. We're not going back there for seconds either.
Well, overall, was that a positive experience for you? Are you going to be doing more blog posts in the future? Or
I don't have any. I don't know. It was nice to be asked to do that, and we'll see if they... Well, I don't know. I have no clue.
Yeah. Cool.
It was something to write, and it was, I was glad to help out.
Yeah. Well, enough about you. Let's talk a little more about you.
Yeah. Let's talk about me.
You've had a busy month here on the podcast.
Yeah. We had Rich Little, Richard Beck, Shane Hipps, Anna Carter Florence, Brian Zond, and most recently, Frank Schaefer. Usually we go in order. Let's go backwards. You want to go counterclockwise? Can we call that counterclockwise?
Sure. Sure. I just finished listening to the Schaefer interview.
Yeah. So I talked with him. The interview was actually recorded Saturday morning. It was supposed to be recorded today, actually, but turns out he was in Dallas-Fort Worth this weekend. And so we met up and did the old podcast. For people who have listened to the show for a long time, they'll know that Rick actually has been on probably 6 or 7 months ago, and he is a mentor. He was the pastor of the mother church that got my church plant started. And we actually did the whole interview in his office. And so when I got done, he texted me and said, how much heresy did you spew in my office? And I said, not that much. And he said he's going to send over a few of his charismatic members to pray out any demons that I've created.
Yeah, there may need to be some cleansing of his office.
You think so?
I don't know. I don't think so. I think we're, first off, let's not call it an interview, because an interview usually involves one person asking multiple questions and then the other person responding. You pretty much ask one question and he went off for an hour. And it was all great material, but he's a talker.
To be fair, at the 20-minute mark, I realized I'm really not going to be doing a whole lot of questioning during this next hour. I had like 2 pages of notes and I'd prepared and I thought, he's got this. I'm just going to be along for the ride. And I was okay with that.
And you were. But his material is really interesting. I thought his story was fascinating. I did wonder, because you have such a wide variety of guests, and you have some that are doing most of their work in biblical studies and making sure we get words like gospel and kingdom right, because that really matters. And then you've got somebody like Schaefer who's saying, hey, look, what the Bible says is what it says, but it's just as important to look into the eyes of your grandkids to understand what God is like. How do you manage the kind of diversity of guests that you're having on the podcast when one is coming from the right angle and the other's coming from the left angle and you're caught in the middle? How does that work?
You know, I think people are smart enough that they can process the stuff on their own. And I think you put interesting people in front of front of them. And I think that's what my job is. I want to facilitate interesting conversations that are going to spark people to do some thinking about things that maybe they never thought before, or help them articulate ideas that they're working with. And I mean, so you have, I think the best example is, you know, we're just talking about Scott McKnight. He was the one talking about kingdom and the specificity of what's kingdom work and gospel work and good works and all that stuff. And then you have Schaefer, who's, you know, basically said Jesus, in his words, said theology is, well, I'm not going to say his words, but theology was useless.
Yep. Yep.
I mean, these are complete opposite messages.
Does Frank Schaefer believe in God or not? The name of his book is what? Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God?
Yeah. Who Believes in God? Yeah.
All right.
Does he believe in God?
Yeah. Based on your conversation with him.
Oh, wow. That's a good question. I have no clue. I really don't know. I read his book. I mean, I listened to him talk for an hour. He is, and by the way, he is extremely friendly. He is a very kind guy. I've really enjoyed corresponding with him before and after. But I have no clue.
Wouldn't he say in response, why does it matter whether he believes in God or not? What matters is what we do with our beliefs.
Yeah, I mean, his basic point is, okay, the atheist, agnostic, theist, triumphant, they're trying to argue, does God exist? And my point, me speaking for Schaefer, is how does it affect you? How do you relate to him?
Right. Stop trying to judge my belief or lack thereof and get serious about what you believe or don't believe.
Yeah. There's one little 2-minute segment that was some of the best stuff I've heard in my podcast, in which he was talking about why he still goes to church. And he's on the scene about going forward to receive the Eucharist with his, you know, granddaughter, grandson on his arm. And there's something in that moment and something about church and what it means. Yeah, he might not know if God exists. He might not know what love means, and he might not know what all the liturgy is he's saying if he really believes those things, but there's something there. And
yeah.
You know, the thing that I like about him is his ability to deal with paradox. And the reason why I would like the voice of what Schaefer has to offer for the Christian community is he's going to say some stuff that's really out there for a lot of people. But I'm far more comfortable with someone who's willing to be honest and say there is paradox. There are things that we don't understand. There are tensions that we can't really get rid of. I'm far more comfortable with someone like that than someone who pretends like those paradoxes don't exist.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. He's absolutely honest too. And I love that he's willing to tell you exactly what it is he can believe and can't believe anymore.
Yeah.
I loved his point though about, for some reason, thinking what you believe either when you're a teenager or when you're 20 years old, that belief is going to be the very same throughout your whole life. It's like falling in love with someone who's 20 years old and assuming you're going to be the same person for the next 60 years.
Yeah.
And I'm not falling in love with the person you are right now. I'm falling in love with who you will become over time. And I think that's a challenging and helpful way to think about belief. I'm committing to God, something other, but I know my beliefs about God, and maybe even the kind of God I believe in, is going to change over time, and yet I remain committed to this concept that there's this other out there that I love and loves me, and I'll discover more about the other as we go along. I think that's fascinating and super helpful.
Yeah.
But I think it's very hard for people to buy into when there's part of their brain also saying, no, the God is the same yesterday, today, and forever. And so the God you believe in right now needs to stay the same all the way through.
Yeah. Now that's got to be even more problematic for someone like you who's gone to school, got a master's degree, committed yourself to this God to serve him in a church setting.
Yeah.
So you sign up, you decide you're going to be a Bible major as a 19-year-old freshman. Is that right? 19, 20-year-old, whatever you were.
I started out as a Bible major, then switched to communication. But yeah, by the time I was 21, I was thinking I'm going to be a minister preacher.
And so now you're 58 and ish, something like that. And you've committed your entire life trajectory based on a commitment you made when you're not even old enough to drink a beer legally.
Right. Yeah.
So obviously you can see the kind of conundrum it puts a lot of pastors in, having to kind of follow that trajectory out.
Oh, I think it is one of the reasons you see so many pastoral flame outs or burnouts is your livelihood and your family stability and well-being are somehow tied to you continuing to believe what you believed 10 years ago, 5 years ago, whenever you last interviewed with the search team that hired you, and you said, this is what I believe. And then a few years later, you suddenly realize, I don't believe this anymore. And then now that my beliefs are shifting, how do I balance speaking to a group of people who have different beliefs than I have, still wanting to connect and communicate with them while not telling them everything I'm thinking?
Why would you tell them everything you're thinking?
Why wouldn't I?
Yeah.
Because they have not come on the same journey with me to come to a different conclusion. And while I would want to invite them on a similar journey, I don't know that it's productive just to suddenly to say, hey, I've been studying this topic for the last 10, 15 years, and I've totally changed my thinking on it. Now let me tell you in 3 points why what I used to believe is wrong. I don't know that that is helpful, and I don't think it brings anybody along because of the boomerang theory. You give people too much new information too soon, it can actually cause them to harden their position and take a step back instead of a step forward. And so you gently lead into maybe some new ways of thinking, yeah, and invite them along. But I also think, and I've talked to other preachers about this, is I don't know many preacher pastor types who actually preach what they believe at a given moment.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I was talking to somebody the other day who will remain nameless. He's been a guest on your podcast before, but he did a series.
Can I guess?
No, you can't guess. Okay. And I would tell you even if you did, but he did a series on, and I said, this, you know, that was really challenging. Is that where you're at? He says, I'm probably not at the same place where I preached from. I preached from where I was at 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. But the problem of preaching where you're at right now is sometimes as your new beliefs are forming or as you're developing a different perspective, you're not sure if you really believe what it is you think you believe right now.
Yeah.
So I'm far more certain of what I believed a year ago, 3 years ago, 5 years ago, than what I might believe right now. So my beliefs haven't settled.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to stand up in front of a room full of people and tell them what I think I believe right now. I'm going to tell them at least, here's what I know I believed a year or two ago when I really had time to process it.
Yeah, I think I heard Rob Bell talk about that. You know, before you go out and preach something, you need to have been, smoking what you're sowing for a long time before you get up and just kind of regurgitate what you just read onto people instead of letting it process into who you are.
Right.
Which makes a lot of sense.
Right. And Rob Bell is not the preacher I was referring to because he has not been on the podcast.
Yeah. Well, maybe one day he'll be lucky enough to fix that.
One can only hope.
Yeah. I'm sure he's thinking about that. So, I was talking to a preacher friend who kind of went through that same experience where he was starting to kind of, you know, read the Brian Zahns of the world and some of the other people who are pushing for a more, and I don't want to say pacifistic view, but a view where he was completely against violence. And so he's reading this stuff, processing it, and he decides, I want to go tell my wife, if an intruder broke into my house right now, I'm not going to protect you. You probably want to think through that one a little bit more clearly before you tell your wife that, especially if she's pregnant at the time.
Yep. I think so. That reminds me, I think it was Reuel Shelley who said that as a preacher, you don't have to tell the congregation everything you know or everything you believe. He said, not even God has chosen to tell us everything he knows.
Wow.
I was like, you know what? I can buy that.
Yeah, that's pretty good. So Brian Zahn.
Yep.
That was my transition and you didn't take it. I was trying to smoothly jump right into Brian Zahn right there. So Brian Zahn was on.
That was just a smooth transition. I didn't even realize you were transitioning.
I know. I was really proud of myself, and then he just destroyed it. It was a good thing he came on because I went to my daughter, who's in kindergarten, her very first like school function. It was a fall festival last weekend, and she's a kindergartner, and I was there with my three-year-old daughter as well and our infant. And my three-year-old daughter was playing on the playground. And this like fifth grade kid who's dressed up in like this full black scary costume is trying to scare my 3 year old daughter. And I wanted to fight him. I wanted to beat up a fifth grader.
Yep.
But luckily I knew Brian Zahn wouldn't be proud of me.
Yeah. That is the problem, isn't it?
That Brian Zahn's never gonna be proud of me?
When nonviolence or a peaceful, I know he doesn't want to be called a pacifist, and I understand that, but whatever you want to call it, that a non-retaliation kind of ethic, in theory, is easy to talk about. But when it's on the street, in your house, or at your daughter's school,
yeah,
totally different situation.
Yeah, exactly. And so his argument is that there's a difference in, you know, attacking someone and policing. You know, there's a difference of scapegoating and policing. And okay, well, where do you draw the line there? I think that's the big question.
Right.
So are we scapegoating by attacking ISIS, or are we policing by trying to prevent them from doing more terrible things?
Right.
I don't know.
Right. And it's always a mess. We always have these conversations as if, and I thought his point on Hitler was really good, in that we have these theoretical conversations about, do we now intervene as if our hands were clean? When in reality, there have been a number of dominoes falling for years now that have helped create the very mess we're now having to enter into violently. I don't know that you have a leg to stand on to suddenly say, no, we're not going to, we've helped create this mess, but now we're going to develop this ethic of non-intervention. Yep. It's tough, very tough.
His basic argument, for those who didn't hear it, was that World War One is really what created Hitler. And so what we did in World War One without rebuilding enabled an environment where Hitler could become Hitler. And so without us doing World War One, then we don't have World War Two.
Right. And there are many who would argue it was actually World War One that sowed the seeds of the same conflicts we're dealing with today. It all goes back to the way the land was broken up and territories were divided after World War One.
Well, all that is way over my head. But what I do know is, okay, so there are clearly problems in the past. There are issues that maybe didn't get handled correctly or were handled as well as people could at the time, but it was not a perfect resolution. And we have a world that's definitely broken, that there's definitely terrible things happening. And how do you respond to that? That's a pretty big question.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't pretend to understand that. And I think we should let someone else answer that question.
Well, we certainly can live in the tension of it, but I thought his basic, at least the entering approach of, okay, let's at least try to understand what we as followers of Jesus can do now with our neighbors, with our allegiance. I think that's important, but this conversation's gone back and forth for centuries now, and I don't know that anybody's ever going to get to a comfortable place with it.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I agree. And it was interesting hearing, I would love to have heard Frank Schaefer talk to Brian Zahn as a father of someone who's in the Marines.
Yeah.
To kind of
figure,
okay, what, and I'm not saying that, you know, Brian Zahn saying, and he specifically says in his book, Christians can serve in the military. I don't know exactly what that means, but
right.
Anyway.
Right. Right. So moving to the next podcast, it was a live.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Anna Florence Carter or Anna Carter Florence?
Let's go with Carter Florence.
All right, good. I'm sure if that's the way she does it, that's the way we'll do it.
Yeah, let's do it that way.
That was a live podcast.
It was, yeah.
But a studio audience. There was a group of ministers, preachers, we were all at a conference. I was in the room for it. I witnessed it firsthand.
You were there.
Interviewed her in front of a live group. First time you've ever done that.
Yeah.
We did a podcast in front of a fake studio audience once. I don't know if you remember that. I kept addressing the audience during the podcast.
And they weren't there.
They weren't there. But
a lot of people have really been perplexed by that.
They helped me. They gave me the strength I needed to keep going.
Yeah.
So what was that like?
Well, it was weird to get the instant feedback. And so there was a few laughter that kind of intoxicated me. So I might have doubled down on the sarcasm up front. And luckily, she was a good sport about it. But it was definitely a different phenomenon, not to mention the fact that you know, we had the wrong kind of mics and it didn't record too well. But it was fun. I enjoyed it. She had a really good sense of humor about it, and I think it would, you know, it was fun.
You may not be the kind of podcaster who needs a crowd egging you on.
It might not be a good thing for me. I'm not sure if it is or not. Okay, so one of the things that we talked about was manuscript preaching. She's a manuscript preacher. She says she doesn't teach her students one way or the other as a homiletics professor at Columbia Seminary, but
right.
That's her style.
Yep.
Ironically, you had gotten up the that afternoon and done a two sessions about public speaking and the importance of being a good communicator, and you would have basically said the exact opposite, that the important thing for a speaker to do is to always maintain eye contact while he is or she is speaking.
I wouldn't have said that it's wrong to use a manuscript. I think there's two kinds of manuscript speakers, those who do it well and those who do it poorly. those who look at their manuscript more than they look at their audience are doing it poorly. There is a way to use a manuscript and still make eye contact and engage your audience. And I think those who do that very well, that's a legitimate way of communicating. I just think you don't see that very often.
You don't see good manuscript communicators.
No, I haven't. I usually feel like, okay, you're just reading this to me, but you're not engaging the audience. You're more attentive to what's in front of you on the page than you are what's in front of you in the seats. And I think that's the problem I always have as a communicator with that kind of manuscript or real note-centric preaching or speaking. It's no. Just look us in the eye and speak from your heart.
Okay, why do those two things seem to go together? Looking someone in the eye, which means you're not looking at your notes, equates to actually speaking from your heart.
I don't know, because they're not related.
So you don't think there's a correlation between looking someone in the eye and actually being more genuine than reading off a piece of paper?
I think it's an impression that's created. If you have a great memory, you can memorize a manuscript and read that manuscript from your mind, recite it, and it's just like you're reading it off the paper, and you can be looking at your audience the whole time and still not be speaking from your heart.
Are you speaking from experience right there?
No, I can do that. I've done that.
You don't ever use notes.
I don't.
Be fair.
That's right. That's right. But I also, I don't get up there and ad-lib my sermons. I know what I'm going to say. I know what direction it's going to go, but I haven't worked out precise wording. And that's the trade-off. For me is, if every word matters and you want to nail every phrase 100% of the time and get the wording just right, you pretty much have to be a manuscript preacher.
Yeah.
Or write it and spend hours memorizing your manuscript and do it word for word. On the other end of the spectrum, if you're not as worried about each word and it's the big ideas and the concepts and you'll just let the flow of the moment help create the language, then you go without notes, but there's always going to be more imprecise communication happening when that's what you're doing.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Do you remember her line about the megachurch pastor who doesn't really seem to follow what they teach in seminaries about how to preach?
Yeah.
She had a line about, you know, something about if it's God-centered, I'm okay with it.
Right.
Which I thought was a great line, because what you see from the preachers who are at the bigger churches typically they're not following the rules that homileticians like Dr. Anna Carter Florence are teaching their students. Why do you think that is?
Well, I don't know what is a correlation and what is causation. So is somehow a communicator style, is that going to attract a larger audience, build a bigger church? Or does it just so happen that if you grow up and find your way comfortable in what would be a megachurch movement, you're going to be more of a face-to-face, non-manuscript preacher? I don't know. I don't know that for sure. It seems to me a lot of what is taught in homiletics classes is different from the way those guys create or get their messages or prepare them, is the question that arises. So a homiletics professor is going to teach, read the text, God's the subject, what is God doing in the text, and that's the gospel. So out of what activity you see God doing in the text, your sermon is now a God statement, well-constructed God statement to the church, reminding the church what God is doing through the gospel. It seems to me a lot of the other way that happens is you look at the congregation, you say, now what are the questions, what are the issues, what are the major problems that this group of people are working through? How can I lift that question out of their hearts and then use the gospel to address it?
Yeah.
And those create two very different kind of sermons.
And the second one is what most people want to hear, I think.
I think if a goal is to draw a bigger crowd, I think you will draw a bigger crowd with the second kind of
I think the stuff that people typically talk about are, and I don't mean this pejoratively to say, you know, Dr. Phil moments, but I think, you know, speaking to someone's felt needs, giving them practical steps to improve that situation and to deal with like the real struggles they have and articulate maybe a slightly nuanced way of seeing it differently and kind of got it up. I think that those are the moments that people typically resonate with, and that generates a kind of buzz that you don't really always find in more of a homiletics class.
You've got a bit, don't you? You've shared it with me before. What you think a good sermon needs to have?
Yeah, yeah. I've got, and I've never shared this with people for probably a reason. But, okay, so the the four parts of a sermon, like, I think you have to be, like, wear four hats. And I think, okay, let's say the Dr. Phil part. So that's, okay, so these are some next steps for you, and this is me giving you some
sort of self-helpy.
Self-help stuff.
Yep, yep.
And then I think you have to also be the historian, like the professor. And so okay. You're going to give some, and you probably can't double down on this one because that's the one that typically bores people.
Right.
But this is what's going on in the text, and this is the background, and this is the cultural stuff that you need to unpack, and you know, all that stuff.
Prove that you're an expert. You went to school and you read the Bible more carefully than the people in your church do.
Exactly. Yeah, you got to do your, you know, your commentary work, and that's what that is.
Yes.
The third part is you've got to be the football coach. Who says, you know, you channel your inner Coach Taylor from Friday Night Lights and say, come on, guys, you guys can do this. Keep it going. You're doing all right.
The
rah-rah motivator thing.
So we've got the professor, the self-help guru, and the motivator.
Yep. And the last one is you've got to be the ministainer, which that's an homage to Friends, I believe. But you can't just say something. You've got to communicate it in a way that's memorable. And I think this is – you could get this from Jesus. I mean, he tells parables. He could have told those in basic – you know, four point lessons, but instead he tells stories that really draw people in.
Right.
And so you got to package it in a way that is memorable.
Memorable. You call that the comedian almost if you wanted to. There's an element where you got to be entertaining as you're sharing all this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. The entertainer.
Yeah. I probably should write that out and email it to Anna so she can use it for her next book.
So you're a professor, you're a motivator, a guru, and an entertainer.
Exactly.
And we wonder why preachers are burning out.
Yeah, I don't, that's not a whole lot of pressure. You don't, yeah.
Right. Right. You know, which one of those are you best at as a preacher?
Well, all of them, of course.
Remember, we can download your sermons and listen to them.
Yeah, luckily I don't link that on this podcast. Which one am I best at? That's a really good question. I don't know. I feel like I can do the Dr. Phil and the and I think I put a lot of time and emphasis on, because I speak to a younger crowd and it's, you know, average age is around 30, and so I feel like a greater pressure to make sure that you have the ministainer part down where it's communicated in a way that's engaging to that audience. So I've probably invested a lot more in that. What about you?
Which one are you worst at? What's your biggest challenge?
Well, one of those other two that I didn't mention, I guess. I don't think, I went to school, I have an MDiv, so it's not like I feel like I have a difficult time, you know, doing the text work. And so, right. You know, maybe some of the more like coach stuff, the rah-rah, keep it up, guys, because that's just not really natural for me.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think I'm very comfortable doing the professor theology stuff. Here's what the text says. Here's the context of it. My temptation is always probably to do more of that than I should. I don't do the self-help guru stuff very well.
Mm-hmm.
I sometimes have a hard time finishing up with some next steps or next actions or here's what you need to do in response to that.
Yeah.
So,
well, we're not really taught to do that. You kind of have to pick that up on your own.
Right. And in some ways, you might even be encouraged not to do it. Like, who are you to think for these people and tell them what to do? Aren't they adults?
Yeah.
And isn't the Holy Spirit going to guide them into some next actions? Who are you to determine the next actions for your church?
Yeah, that's interesting because you hear, you know, some preachers that I guess have turned off that part of their brain that says, you're not really an expert in the subject, but they give, this is what you do for your marriage, and this is what you do for your finances, and this is what you do in your politics. And I think that generates typically a lot of interest from people when they give those very practical things to do, even though preachers, they don't have training. They're not counselors. You know, they're not financial gurus. They're not any of those things.
Right.
But that's what people like to hear.
Yeah. Yeah. And preachers should never make economic statements. That's one rule I've given for myself is I'm never going to talk about economic theory in my sermons because I've talked to enough economists and read enough about it to know it is so complex that it cannot, should not be talked about in a 2 or 3 minute section of a sermon because I'm most likely getting it wrong.
And that's one of the things that's frustrating when you hear some preachers talk about science stuff is that they will completely disregard an entire field of knowledge and say, well, you know, I don't think that's right.
Yeah.
But then other times they use it as a proof text for what they're trying to say.
Yeah.
And so I think that's just like disrespectful to the other sciences that you're going to say, okay, well, I trust you with one thing, but not everything.
Yeah.
Let's talk about another preacher.
Yeah.
Shane Hipps.
Yes.
I feel like you guys would be good friends.
He's not a preacher anymore. Can you call him a preacher still?
Well, I haven't given up on him. I feel like we're going to get him back. I feel like about every 3 months, I'm going to call him up and say, Shane, what can we do to get you back in the pulpit?
Yeah. I like Shane's stuff. I enjoyed that podcast too.
Yeah. He was, he's another good one. I really enjoyed talking with him.
You seem to struggle though. You.
Me?
Yeah. You.
Why?
Really pushed back as he was saying, dig into the desires of your heart, trust your heart to lead you into who you really are and what you really want to do with your life.
What is it? I don't know what that, just kind of blocked that out because I really like Shane and I don't know what in the world that is.
You kept pushing back as if for some reason maybe we shouldn't trust our hearts, that the desires of our hearts could lead us astray.
Well, my heart was saying, don't trust this. That's what. Yeah. I think that is, it's like humanism 101. Like if you go inside yourself enough, you'll find like your essence and that's the beautiful part of you and that's what you need to, you know, live out of. But I think there is a lot of reason to believe that there is a lot of junk in a lot of people's hearts.
Right.
And if you look enough in there, that you're going to find some very dark areas that if you listen to them, they will take you down some really dark paths.
Yeah.
And that's my fear. Do you not think that?
No, I understand why you think that. But I think I probably agreed more with Shane because he wasn't saying that everything that's coming out of your heart, you should act on, right?
Yeah.
But to somehow put a negative by something that comes out of your heart instead of just evaluating it and saying, I desire this. The fact that I desire it isn't wrong. Now, what I do with that desire could end up being difficult, could create some problems for me.
But this is where I push back and I would say the desire to be famous. Okay, let's just go with that one.
Right.
Okay, he would twist it and say, well, that's just a desire to be loved.
Right.
And we just misconstrue our desire to be loved and that's a good thing.
Yeah.
But that's not the whole thing. Part of the desire is that we're egomaniacs. Like, I want the world to be about me, and that's not a good thing I need to listen to.
Right. Yeah. But it also, I'm still going to come back, though, and say just because that's your desire, it's what you do with it and how you act on it. And why do you desire that?
Yeah.
And so I get a sense, I sense what he's saying. If we go around guilt tripping ourselves all the time because we desire something. I desire money. I desire the comfort that comes from wealth. I desire the warmth that comes from walking into a room and having people glad that I'm there. Those aren't necessarily negative. If we frame them as negative, then what do? Well, I'm not supposed to desire that. How do I turn off desires in my heart? Because I convince myself it's wrong to have that desire. Is that even possible?
Yeah, probably not.
And so isn't it better to be honest about your desires, figure out where they're coming from, and maybe if there's a deeper desire behind the desire, the surface desire, I think maybe I misheard, but I think that's what he's getting at is keep pushing to the very basement and find out what's at the heart of your desire.
Yeah.
Could that give birth to something good and energizing in your life?
Yeah. So that's part of the homework that he assigns is that let's spend 15, 20 minutes a day, whether writing it, you know, literally typing it out or meditating on it and try to figure out what's really in there that you're really, you know, drawing after and that you really want. And I think that self-discovery is very helpful.
Yeah. I thought it was good. I don't know why you're so against desires.
I'm for desires as long as they're good ones.
Okay. Well, and I'm glad you have set yourself up as the judge and jury of whether desires are good or not.
I'm a preacher. I get to decide these things.
I forgot. You're the guru.
I'm a guru. That's one of the hats I wear. I've got three other I can put on if you need me to.
All right.
Yeah. Well,
so excited you about this month, these sessions.
Hmm?
What other shows excited you? I keep calling them sessions. I know they're shows.
Yeah, they're shows. Well, I feel bad about what happened in the end of the Beck show when we started talking about Nadia, and I jokingly made a comment about, you know, what Nadia didn't technically call Beck a funny name, but it was said, and so there was obviously a lot of jest in that, and then it kind of like took a life on its own on the interweb, and so I wanted to clarify. She likes Beck likes her, we're all friends here, just a little good-natured banter back and forth.
Right, and the two of them, they throw profanity around like it means nothing. So just because it's used, it doesn't mean.
I know.
Again, it's not necessarily negative, Luke. It just is.
It just is, yeah. And that's what my old friend Richard would say. Let's just be present in it. And let those two overly tall, overly expletive using, inked up people do their thing, and we can all be happy for them.
Now, I do have a question for you, though, about like iTunes. Because iTunes usually they have these distinctions on podcasts, whether they have explicit language or whether they're family friendly. And which, you know, by the way, if you haven't subscribed to this podcast on iTunes, I encourage you to do that. If you're listening right now, you can also go and leave a rating. The more positive, the better. Helps our friend Luke out.
Thank you, Wade.
I do wonder. Comments too, right? You can leave comments.
Yes, you can do all of that.
I just got off on iTunes there for a second. But have you had to go into iTunes and change the category so that
Naughties can be on there? I really feel like I should have.
Downloading explicit content, because Mr. Schaefer used some salty language as well.
Yeah, I probably should have demarcated that one as a little not so clean.
And what's it going to do to your family, your parents, maybe those who have the highest hopes for you to know that you are now the host of an explicit podcast.
Yeah, we're just going to delete that part of the podcast. Or we're going to pretend like it didn't happen. We're just going to listen to their desires. The desires he just really wanted to be understood and heard, and that's all he could use to reach out to the world. Is he was grasping for any language that would get his heart to be fulfilled.
Yeah.
So we're not going to judge that desire.
All right. So we're going to keep this a clean podcast, or are you going to let it be explicit?
We're going to keep it clean.
All right. You may need to have a conversation with your future guests.
Yeah, we might need to.
It's getting sloppy around here, buddy.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
So what was it like to be – okay, I'm making an assumption here that as the podcaster, the host, you're in a position of authority. You found yourself in an authoritative position over someone who used to have authority over you back at Harding when you first went to college. Isn't that correct?
When I had Rich on.
What was that?
Oh, I mean, that was fun. I mean, it was more exciting for me to kind of hear his journey because, you know, I went to college at Harding. I was really young when I got there. I was 16, and he was like the paragon of like the type of religion that I, you know, was signing up to at that point. Yeah. And then we go our separate ways, and I don't see him for another, you know, 15 years or something. And he and I kind of both arrived at the same destination, completely independent of each other. And so to hear his journey and hear how he got to be where he was interesting to me. Because I think the kind of the progression that he went through is kind of a very typical one for a lot of people. And it all hinges upon how you understand the Bible.
Right. And isn't he part of the larger conversation that Frank Schaefer is saying we need to be having? That what you believed when you were 16 or what you believed when you were 30 isn't necessarily going to be where you're at when you're 60.
Yeah.
And a large part of that is going to come back to how you read the Bible.
Yeah.
And you know, Peter Enns, another guest you've had recently, leads us in that direction.
Yeah. You know what's interesting is I was talking to Beck about this off mic, and he was saying that it's not really how you read the Bible, which is how you know I just described and how I typically think of it, and
right.
even how Enns would say it. He says it's how you view God because you will twist the way that you read the Bible to fit your view of God.
Yeah.
And so if your view of God changes, then you're going to find a way to reread Scripture to come up with a way that makes that line up.
And that's what we all do.
Yeah.
I've got a friend that, and Richard mentioned this and too, that who is really, he can't buy into penal substitution, a theory of atonement anymore.
Does he say why?
He can't believe in a God that would need to punish somebody for sin. That he's willing to take out his anger on, oh, I can't punish you, I'll punish my son instead. Yep. He just can't go there anymore. And to the degree that he even struggles with the idea of any kind of substitution theory of atonement, any kind of even representational theory of atonement. And I push him back and say, look, dude, there's a lot of stuff in Scripture where some of this is there. It wasn't ripped out of thin air. So how are you going to make sense of these bits where, say, as an example, Jesus is killed instead of Barabbas? There's some substitution going on there. It's not necessarily penal, but there's some substitution. And it's really hard for him to embrace right now because he's having a hard time seeing a God who would just make this arbitrary substitution for, all right, not you, but you. And because you died, I'll forgive all of them.
Yeah.
That makes sense to him anymore. And it doesn't matter what the Bible says about it.
He's just going to get rid of it.
Seems like it.
Yeah. Well, I think that's, yeah, I think it's a temptation for all of us to do it. And there are definitely things, if you're going to like hold clearly defined theological stances, you know, say the Calvinist versus Arminian thing, you're not going to read certain parts of Scripture. And you're going to say, yeah, I'm this one, and so I'm going to ignore, you know, there are chunks of Scripture that really cause some serious problems to show up in your theologies if you're going to do that. And that's the difference between what typical, you know, Christianity is going to do and then what Schaeffer's saying, is that there's paradox, okay? And we have to be comfortable with it. And that's what I think his voice is so important for.
Right. I agree. So you got a big month coming up.
Yeah, we've got a few people coming up in November. We've got a few guests booked already. I think it should be a decent month.
Are you going to do No Shave November?
I don't really think it'd actually make that much of a difference for me, but probably not.
All right, so you're not really interested in growing a beard?
No, not
but
really.
But you're going to grow your guest list. Anybody you can tell us about?
Well, you know, I think a good podcaster doesn't book and tell.
Yeah, you would certainly like to, though, wouldn't you?
Well, you know,
true or false? Let's play true or false.
Okay. All right.
True or false? There are certain guests, potential guests, that you would put on your white whale list, as in Moby Dick. I can't believe I would ever get this person on the show.
Yeah. There are probably a few on there. Yeah, true. True. Yeah, true or false. True.
True or false? There is a chance that one of your white whales is going to be landed on the Newsworthy with Norsworthy show this month.
Well,
a chance. I'm not saying it's going to happen. There's just a good chance.
I would go with true to that statement. True.
Would you want to give us a hint as to who that might be?
No. I mean, if I gave any hints, I think it would just cause too many bells to ring and people would know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Speaking of which, and I love, we were talking about classic literature. Moby Dick is a great book. Have you ever read Hemingway's For Whom the Bell Tolls?
No, I haven't. I haven't read that.
Good book. You might want to check into it very soon.
Yeah, I would, but I would hate to, you know, rob you of any joy you would have of explaining it to me.
Well, I can't wait to see who it might be.
Yeah, me too. Me too. Well, Wade, thank you for joining me for another wrap-up show. This has been thrilling as always.
It is a pleasure.
And we're going to, you know, we're going to just send this out to the people and let them know that we were suited up for this high-class, high-quality podcast.
That's right. Just keep casting that pod, buddy. It's what you do best.
Done.
Thanks for checking out Newsworthy with Norsworthy. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You are now adjourned.